I always wanted to know who the best player was on tour simply because I wanted to actually work as hard. And then I ran into a little guy by the name of George Knutson out of Canada. And I watched him hit the golf ball. I watched him with the wide stance, taking the club back way inside, releasing the club. One of the greatest ball strikers I'd ever seen.
Now Ballesteros. With a putt that could win him the 113th British Open.
Hello and welcome to a brand new edition of the McKellar Golf Podcast. My name is Lawrence Donegan and I'm joined this week, or at least I will be joined this week, by my good pal and co-host Mark Cannizzaro of the New York Post. Our guest is Ian Carter, the BBC's golf correspondent, and we talked to Ian about all sorts of good stuff, but mostly about the strategic partnership, I think they call it, between the European Tour and the PGA Tour. It sounds very dry and boring, but actually, once you start digging into it, it's a really, really interesting subject with lots of fallout, lots of politics, and lots of implications for the long-term future of professional golf. So that's really fun and interesting. Then we chatted about Rory McIlroy and why everybody picks on Rory. The latest assailant is Tom Weisskopf, a great player in his own right, but he seems to have a bee in his bonnet about Rory. Anyway, we have a chat about that. But before we get to all of that, I want to introduce you to our new friends at Sounder Golf. Those of you with a long memories might recall Sounder as the brand of clubs that Seve played when he first came on the scene in the 1970s. Now it's been reborn as a brand for people who love golf but hate the pros play mentality of the golf industry. Sounder sells stylish and hard-wearing clothes that look great on the course, in the office, or out for dinner on the town. They've launched a tour-quality three-piece golf ball as well that arrives packed loose in 100% organic cotton ball bags. Less packaging, more efficient shipping, and therefore better for the planet, which can't be a bad thing. They've also got a fantastic selection of accessories, including socks, hats, caps, socks, belts, and tees. And we are very excited about having a partnership with Sounder. They are bringing out the McKellar Beanie, perfect winter golf hat, and it will be coming soon. It's all available at www.soundergolf.com. There's free shipping in the UK when you spend £100. They can also ship to the US and Europe too with free shipping worldwide on orders over £200. And added bonus, enter McKellar15 at the checkout for a 15% discount on your first order. That's McKellar15. Check it all out at www.soundergolf.com. Okay, the other piece of business I have to talk about is the arrival of the latest edition of McKellar. It's number 4. It's out now. You can find it at McKellarmagazine.com. It's it's brilliant, but you'd expect me to say that, but it really is brilliant, right up there with previous three. If you go to our Twitter feed or look on the website, you'll see the contents. A lot of really, really great writers that you may know of already, and a lot of new ones as well. It's really thrilling that it's out there. You go there, get your copy now, McKellarmagazine.com, and while you're on there, you might notice that we have a brand new quotes and quotes product, the McKellar box set. That is all four magazines brought together in a beautiful presentation slipcase. It's gorgeous. I've been taking it around and showing it to people, and the reaction has been phenomenal. So I'm really, really glad we did. Anyway, that's enough selling. Let's get on with the show.
Mark Cannizzaro, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lawrence. Thanks for having me on.
I mean, just to let the listeners into a little of our interior lives, you were shouting out at the car dealer earlier on, the car mechanic.
Well, I was. I delayed our podcast with a little bit of a rant with an auto garage here in New York City that's been taking me over to the taking me to the woodshed, if you will.
A New York auto mechanic. I can't imagine. Good luck with that. You have
Don't ever get stuck and have car trouble in Manhattan. Just trust me on that.
Anyway, Mark, you work for the golf correspondent for the New York Post and also all sorts of other columns. So it's a pretty high-level podcast today. Our guest is of a similarly high level, Ian Carter, golf correspondent at the BBC. Ian, how you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you for having me.
Here, speaking of interior lives, what about exterior lives? What's, as a golf correspondent for the BBC, what's... Are you working? Are you going to events? What's your schedule like?
Yeah, I'm working, and actually, I think it's fair to say I've had a really busy year, because even in the first lockdown that we had over here, golf was as newsworthy as any sport, yeah. If not more. So there was, you know, a lot of work to do. Then, of course, the sport was one of the first to come back. Unfortunately, a lot of what I've been covering, I've been doing from where I'm sitting right now, which has been at home, or when it's been the majors, we've been decamping to our studios in the northwest of England and getting feeds in. So, you know, doing the Masters from Salford compared with Augusta, and likewise the one that really got me was the PGA, when I could have been in San Francisco and I was in Salford. That was very disappointing, because of course it was finishing at 3 o'clock in the morning as well. So I felt like I'd got the jet lag and I hadn't seen the Golden Gate Bridge by the end of it. So that was very frustrating. I've been to a few tournaments. You know, we had BMW PGA at Wentworth, the British Masters, which was the first tournament back on the European Tour. And actually the biggest highlight for me was the one major that I managed to get to, which was the Women's Open at Royal Troon, which was a fantastic occasion. And actually, you know, even in the absence of spectators, had a really big time feel to it. Great story with Sophia Popov. And you know, I thoroughly enjoyed that week. Probably the most enjoyable week of this extraordinary year that we've all encountered.
Here, you spoke there about Wentworth. I mean, that's the biggest event in the European Tour of the year. I mean, strictly European Tour event. What was Wentworth like? Because that's usually 25 deep on every fairway, isn't it? I mean, it's packed. It's such a tight property.
Yeah, I mean, it was somewhat surreal, of course. Yeah. It was different, as all sport has been. But one of the things that I think has come out of this is that golf hasn't felt terribly out of place, you know, as a result of what's gone on, because it is a sport that's played in silence. I think where we've really missed the crowds, and we did at Wentworth and every tournament, is those sort of climactic moments when you want to see the galleries giving due reception to great performances, as was the case there with Tyrrell Hatton, especially, you know, for the likes of Bryson DeChambeau at the US Open, and also Dustin Johnson at the Masters. And of course, you know, there have been iconic shots that have been hit in silence, which has been frustrating. But by the time we got to Wentworth, it didn't feel that different. I can remember listening to Mark on this podcast, you know, when you discussed the first tournament back at Colonial, and there, Mark, you were saying, weren't you, how you actually got quite used to the absence of the spectators and the spirit of competition kind of carries you through.
I did, Ian. And, you know, what you mentioned about Wentworth is what I would say about Augusta. I got a little bit used to the lack of fans because I've done about, you know, six or seven events prior to the Masters, including the PGA in San Francisco, which you referenced, and the US Open at Wingfoot, which was a home game for me here in New York. You know, but I always felt that Augusta was going to be where we were going to feel it most, and it absolutely was the case. You know, those roars that we're so used to hearing, you know, from the big grandstands down at 13 and 15, and you know, certainly the people surrounding 18 and all over the golf course. That was the most surreal thing to me. On a selfish level, at Augusta, for me, I was able to be up close to more shots than I ever had been walking around the golf course. And what you just referenced, Ian, a minute ago, about how golf has been the one sport that seems to have carried on a little bit in normalcy, is, you know, certainly it takes place outdoors. And as you said, most groups play in silence. You know, it's the Rory McIlroys and Tiger Woods and Mickelsons and DJs. You know, those are the guys that have all the huge galleries. But if you walk around most golf tournaments, almost every other guy on that 156 or 144 person field or whatever it may be has, you know, girlfriends, wives, you know, parents or a couple friends, a smattering of people outside the rope. So it's not that much different to those guys. It's more different to the stars that are used to having, like Lawrence said, 25 deep on the ropes. And as a sports writer covering these things, because I cover other sports here, obviously, in you know, I cover football and a number of other things here in New York. And at least with golf, we've been able to have personal interaction, albeit from a distance, with the players. Whereas, just as an example, you know, for football, you know, we're three quarters of the way through the National Football League season here, which I cover very heavily here. And I have not literally looked a player or a coach in the eye since the all year. I mean, dating back to, you know, before the training camps began, which were in the summer, which obviously we were in the midst of the pandemic already. So everything is done on a Zoom call now. Every interview, every interview is either on television, I mean, telephone or a Zoom call. Whereas golf, you know, you can at least look a guy in the eye and ask him a question or her a question. So in that manner, I think golf has been a little bit of a salvation. I know selfishly for me, because, you know, you're at least able to have some semblance of a conversation with somebody, you know, in personally, other than on a Zoom call where there's 25 other people listening to your questions, right?
Here, Mark, compare the two sports and how they've handled the pandemic. Because, I mean, the Denver Broncos had four quarterbacks out, COVID-related absences at the weekend. It seems like golf's done pretty well relative to other sports over here, hasn't it?
Lawrence, I think it has. And, you know, as all of our readers of McKellar, you know, I wrote a little bit about that. I went into it a bit cynically thinking, you know, Ian, you referenced the first tournament back that I was at a Colonial, which the first PGA Tour event back. And I was a bit alarmed at the so-called sham that the bubble, you know, that they were supposedly created was. I was very skeptical. And as sports writers and journalists, we are always a bit skeptical. And, you know, as months passed and so few players tested positive, I was shocked at how well it's done. And, you know, Lawrence, you just referenced, you know, here in the States, the Denver Broncos, and it's happened around to other teams as well, but most recently the Broncos, you know, they basically had no quarterbacks available to play last Sunday. You know why? Because they weren't wearing masks, and with the contact tracing, one of them tested positive, and because of the protocols, the other guys had to sit out, excuse me, for a week as well. So, you know, you're always going to have people that aren't going to take it seriously enough. And listen, we're all seeing it around us. I'm sure Ian, you in England, and us, Lawrence, you in the West Coast, me here, there's just always going to be people that aren't taking it seriously enough, or there's, you know, pandemic fatigue or whatever you want to call it. And you know, that certainly has happened in some of the other sports. And I think if you look at the numbers in golf, it's, and particularly, you cannot have a bubble in golf. These guys are all independent contractors. They stay in different places, different hotels, houses, whatever. And I think it's remarkable, to be honest with you, the how little the pandemic has affected the actual competition in golf.
Yeah, we're going to come on to the European Tour. Ian, the European Tour has done pretty well, hasn't it?
I mean, it's done extremely well, yeah. Lawrence. And actually, you know, Mark saying there you can't have a bubble in golf, well, you can on the European Tour. And I remember having a long conversation with Ian Poulter when he came over for the Scottish Open and then the BMW PGA at Wentworth. And he was saying, you know, just how much more strict it was over here. And the reason being is because it's such an international tour, and they needed to put a bubble in place for the government to allow athletes to travel here to compete and not have to go through the quarantine that they otherwise would have to. So it is really very, very strict. We had, there was one guy, I forget his name now, early on, who was thrown out of the tournament because he'd gone to the pub.
That was the American guy, wasn't it? Caitlin, John Caitlin, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Well done. Yeah, and you know, it is really strict. And when you go to, I remember the British Masters, I actually had a terrible toothache that week. And I needed to, in the end, I went and saw the tour doctor, And he said, "Have you got any painkillers?" And I said, "Well, I'm starting to run out." And he said, "Oh, well, because I can give you some." I said, "Well, don't worry, I could pop into the local drugstore on the way back to the hotel." He said, "No, you can't do that. You'd be breaking the bubble." And that's how serious it is. You can literally go to the hotel and the golf course. And if you go to a shop or a bar or a restaurant that isn't part of that bubble, you're in breach of it, and you're out of it, whether you're a player, a caddy, an administrator, or a member of the media. So they have enforced that very, very strictly. And it has worked, you know. And as a result, they've managed, I think the European Tour deserve massive credit for the number of tournaments that they've put on. Yeah, the prize funds have plummeted, but they have kept their members playing. It's been a monumental effort.
I think somebody told me that you're right, it's a monumental effort, but somebody told me they had to get these tournaments played. I think it would have cost them 40 million or something. They would have to have handed Sky back 40 million, I think. And what I meant as well, Ian, was that financially, I mean, 6 months ago we had Jamie Corrigan from The Telegraph on. It was a cataclysmic version of what might happen to a European Tour, but between me, Jamie, and Huggy, it did well. It got a bunch of tournaments on. It's got two tournaments on this week. So they've done well pandemic wise, and they've done well financially. Well, hang on a minute, relatively. I think was it 60 people were made redundant in the European Tour? Was it something like that?
68, I believe.
Which is brutal.
Yeah, and I mean, that's I know this is something that we're coming on to talk about. It's been a, you know, a huge story. The strategic alliance.
Oh, here we go. Called. Is that what it's called?
It's a strategic alliance between the European Tour and the PGA Tour that got announced last Friday, very hastily. And that actually prompted me. It was funny when it all kind of surfaced. I got tipped off shortly before the press releases came out. I actually got tipped off from the American side of things rather than the European side of things that this was happening. And then I spoke with Keith Pelley, who said the same thing in the news conference that he did on Zoom or whatever the medium was, and he said, "Look, you know, our finances are robust. Look at our balance sheet." So I did, and more than that, I got someone who knows about finances to look at it as well, and he said, "Yeah, it is true to say that they're in pretty robust shape. They did increase their cash reserves because there'd been a lot of criticism that they'd been run down." And they'd gone up by a few million to, I think, something like 27 million.
That's from right.
20 million. But also, you know, there was interesting stuff in there. You know, amongst that 27 million was a 10 million increase in Ryder Cup receipts upon the signing of Adair Manor as the venue for 2027. So that's kind of a one-off sort of payment that's come in of something like 10 million that has boosted the balance sheet. And of course, those figures refer to the end of 2019. So they don't take account of what's happened here. And one of the really interesting notes in there to me was that they were saying that, you know, they don't expect to be back on an even keel, if you like, until 2023. Now, my mate who looked at it from a financial point of view said that he felt that was just sort of prudent, cautious accountant speak. But it does kind of show you how much the boat has been rocked by the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 10 million from Adair Manor, that's loose change for JP McManus, isn't it? I mean, he'll just find that down the back of his couch. Mark, I think it's fair to say there's this announcement of a strategic alliance. Not one line has appeared in American media. I haven't seen one. Not one. I mean,
it's you know, I think probably, Lawrence, because it affects the European tour more than it does the U.S. tour here. You know, I read Ian's piece that he wrote the other day, and, you know, I read a few things on it. I don't know the financial state that the European tour is in, but everything you hear is that they've been scuffling a little bit over the last few years, obviously, and I mean, this pandemic's hurt everybody, so I don't really take the pandemic into play here, but I think it's probably a good thing at the end of the day. You know, Rory McIlroy made some comments that he thought it was a sign of progress, and I think I agree with him on that. I don't know if Ian, you do, because you're much closer certainly to the European Tour than I am, but you know, I would like to see happen is you know, for the European Tour to carry on the way it has, but maybe in a stronger financial manner and you know, than it has been so far. But I hate to see the so-called lesser tournaments on the European Tour be hurt by this. You know, I've never been a big fan of that proposed superstar league that they wanted to put together. I just never thought that was good for the game. I think this alliance is much better for the game of golf in general than the PGL proposals.
Here, you said, Ian, it was a last minute thing that suggests that there was a it was kind of hurried at the end. There was obviously something afoot. I mean, that's been written about or hinted at. The PGA Tour got wind of this PGL thing, maybe PGL and European Tour sort of hooking up. Was it a bit of shenanigans in the background, a bit of politics, obviously?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I was told, I would say about a month ago, to start to expect something to happen in the next couple of months. I don't know. I think that the PGL thing was the thing that acted as the catalyst. I don't really see what the PGA Tour is getting out of this strategic alliance, other than a seat on the European Tour board, which means that Jay Monahan knows exactly what's going on with an organization that were previously out and out competitors, and this investment in European Tour Productions, which we're led to believe is a 20% stake in the media arm of the European Tour. So what does that give the PGA Tour? Not much, as far as I can see, you know, in terms of their business model. But what it does do is it staves off the threat of PGL. If the Rain Group, which has Saudi money behind it, if they had gone into bed with the European Tour, then this rebel upstart would have got a real leg up in terms of legitimacy. They would have been in there. There's a ready-made circuit that they could invest in. They could create a model that might have been attractive to some very big names in the United States, which therefore could have weakened the PGA Tour. So I suspect that the fact that the European Tour have said that they were in very deep conversations and there was clearly a temptation to go down that route, and the fact that they, I don't know whether they were persuaded out of it, but I suspect they probably were by this kind of alliance with the PGA Tour.
I was going to ask you for a question because I've really thought that the effect of some of the big names like Rory and John Rahm, and I want to say maybe Brooks Koepka as well, kind of denouncing the PGL, I thought that was a death blow to those guys. And I kind of wonder what the alliance of PGL aligning itself with the European Tour, would it have really drawn a lot of these big name players into a so-called world tour? I guess I'm not stating this with a lot of educated thought behind it. It's more of a question, because when I hear these guys, the bigger names of the tour, kind of denouncing it, it makes me wonder if it was going to work anywhere, whether it was in the U.S. or Europe or wherever.
Well, they have deep pockets and they are determined. That's obvious. I would have thought, like you, Mark, that when the top three players in the world turned around and said, look, not interested, then that would have been it, given the sums of money that are said to be involved and the fact that you do need to pin it on a big, big name. But equally, we know that they have turned the heads of various big name players, and so therefore I think what they needed was a bit of legitimacy. I think they needed a potential circuit. You look at the Rolex series on the European Tour, $8 million tournaments that are all around the world. You know, you have half a dozen of those, up to 10 of those. That's starting to get very close to the PGL model. And if you're signing up players who are going to be guaranteed to bank $130,000 simply for turning up, then you're going to get a really good field, especially from the European side of things. And if your pockets are deeper than those of the European Tour, then you've got a chance, haven't you, of pulling an established golf body onto your side. So I can see how it's worked that way. But then if you're in the European Tour's position and you're thinking, well, how would it look to be basically funded by Saudi Arabia? That's, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, a stop on your circuit, but to be fundamentally funded by Saudi Arabia is quite the other thing. And of course, you know, as from a European Tour perspective, in all probability, you'd be going forward without the likes of Rory McIlroy, who's a massive figure as far as Europe's concerned. So, and John Rahm. So it then made sense that if the offer was there to hook up with the PGA Tour, then it makes sense for the European Tour to do that. So I think we've arrived at a position where PGL has been a catalyst, but actually it's the preferred option for both parties to come together. The two parties that have come together.
Can I just going back, you mentioned earlier that the PGA Tour is basically getting nothing out of this. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. But what's the European Tour getting out of it? They're getting co-sanctioned events. They're getting more playing opportunities for European players. So if, say, the Scottish Open becomes a co-sanctioned event and, I don't know, some European-based player wins the Scottish Open, that's him got a two-year exemption on the PGA Tour. So the European Tour players are going to love this. If the PGA Tour is involved in events on the European Tour, you would assume that the sponsorship money will go up, the prize money might go up. I mean, Keith Pelley's won a watch, hasn't he? I mean, he really has. He's got quite a bit of stuff for not giving away very much. You said 20%, I heard 10, whatever it is, plus a bit of cash to restore the books or to to put the accounts in, you know, in better health. And it's pretty good negotiation from Keith Pelley. He's obviously leveraged this PGL stuff, hasn't he, pretty well.
That's what it feels like, doesn't it, Lawrence?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think potentially you're right, but one thing that I think the PGA Tour does get out of this, and they already had it to a large degree, is that they can boss the calendar. They can shape a world calendar now. So, for example, the BMW PGA, I mean, it's already happened, hasn't it? But that now comes after the FedEx Cup playoffs. When, you know, there could be a bit of fatigue in there, and what are the incentives for Americans to come over and play in that? But equally, you know, that globalization of the schedule, you know, it's epitomized by Patrick Reed, isn't it? And it works really well for him and others. Colin Morikawa is a European Tour member. It could work really, really nicely, but I'd be worried if I was one of those sort of rank and file European Tour players who's at the moment getting into those Rolex Series events, but might not if there was an influx of PGA Tour players coming in. And then what happens, you know, what happens to them? And is the pyramid going to be there, the kind of tournaments that Mark was talking about that you don't want to see go, but might in this environment?
Ian, it certainly seems like, and Lawrence, it certainly seems like the middling to little guy on both of these tours is going to be hurt. You know, I mean, it's just the mathematics of it. You know, doesn't it? I mean, it just doesn't, well, you know, it just seems like this is going to be a problem for, you know, for the lower half of these tours. But the lower half of these tours are not what sells the TV revenue and draws the audience.
Can I just jump in? Ian, you covered tennis for a long time. Basically, what we're looking at, basically a world tour, and then with various satellite circuits. I mean, how does it work in tennis? Does it work well, or is it a mess, or are the little guys screwed? The only thing I know about minor league tennis is there's a lot of gambling problems and a lot of match fixing. That's the only thing I know about that level of tennis.
Yeah, and that's because the prize money is so small in those events. You can make more by having a dodgy bet, I think, and that's, you know, that's an inherent weakness and problem that they have. It's a long time since I've worked in tennis now, Lawrence, but you know, there you had the ATP on the men's side and the WTA on the women's side, and they could run effectively parallel circuits and then bring all of the top players together at appointed times in the calendar. So you would suddenly get, you wouldn't have tournaments that might draw away the best players when it was, say, Indian Wells and Key Biscayne, Miami, the Italian Open, for example. And it would be coordinated around the majors as far as the tennis is concerned. So you'd have a grass court run up to Wimbledon, hard courts ahead of the US Open, the Australian Open, and clay ahead of the French Open. And so it could be coordinated. I was interested when Keith Pelley was asked about that ATP model, and he said, well, that is not something that we have discussed. The one thing that he did say has been discussed to quite a lot of detail is this idea of co-sanctioning events so that PGA Tour players could play in European Tour events and presumably vice versa.
Well, guys, if I could just jump in for a second. To me, the elephant in the room for this entire alliance is the Ryder Cup. That has been the blood and guts event, you know, of golf, you know, every couple of years. And will this in any way dull that kind of blood and guts and competition and the spirit of that rivalry? I think that's a fascinating element to this.
There's an interesting aspect to it as well, in that while the European Tour is obviously the organization from the European perspective as far as the Ryder Cup is concerned, there's another organization that has to come into it, and that is the founding sort of partner, which is the Professional Golfers Association, the PGA in Great Britain.
Oh, yeah.
And because if the PGA Tour were to get their hands on the Ryder Cup, it would have to be with the permission and presumably at a price that has to be paid to the founding partners of it, which is the Professional Golfers Association. So there are a lot of talks to be had around that as well, and I'm sure it's something that they would want massively, the PGA Tour, to have a slice of. And again, it gives the European Tour something of a bargaining chip.
And what does that do to the PGA of America?
Oh, least, yeah.
You know, that's they've got to be kind of, you know, that's, you know, I mean, we're way ahead on that, I suppose, you know, but that has to be some sort of threat, I would have to think, to the PGA of America.
Here, but that, isn't it? It's funny that the PGA Tour, the most powerful organization in golf, doesn't have a piece of any of the five biggest events. I think that's always tickled me. Here,
It hasn't tickled the PGA Tour, though, Lawrence.
Well, actually, Ian, so if it's 10 or 20%, and Jay Monahan's only one voice at the table, I think there's 15 board members, he'll be the one PGA Tour guy. I mean, how much influence will he have? Will he be able to push the European Tour around on calendars and events and scheduling and, I don't know, is it?
I mean, he's a very influential voice. I think he's a very clever man, isn't he? And I think that I think the European Tour, well, Keith Pelley said it. He, you know, they're very excited to have his input, his insight, and his ideas. And that's how the relationship is being presented. You're right. He's one voice of 15, but I think he'll be one of those voices that will be listened to very, very carefully.
Here, the overall reaction has been, if you go just Google it, Paul McGinley wrote a piece on Sky saying cheerleading. Danny Willett was cheerleading Rory. Somebody contacted me yesterday and pointed out what could, from a European Tour perspective, what might go wrong. I'll read out this list and you can jump in. The first one was that PGA Tour has proven itself to be a pretty selfish partner when it came to World Golf Championships. It basically pushed every other federation around, and it's the American World Golf Championships. More layoffs, you know, when you have organizations coming closer together. They might, you know, they call it all sorts of, there's all sorts of euphemisms, synergies, you know, if the PGA Tour and the European
consolidation,
Tour,
isn't
that,
it?
That's, yeah.
They That's one of the words.
They come together and, oh, lo and behold, we don't need two PR departments. Let's just have one. So there's half the PR department gone. Oh, we don't need two digital media teams. Let's have one.
I know which one we'd take, though, Lawrence.
Oh, first. You got to admit that, Mark, haven't you? I mean, not that you're a PGA Tour. I mean, the European Tour social media is the best, isn't it? Better than PGA Tour.
It might be better than any sport.
Yeah.
Just golf. It's, I mean, their creativity is incredibly awesome.
The other one, Ruthless in Pursuit of Their Self-Interest, the PGA Tour, true. Do we really want... I think the European Tour is about to announce a new schedule pretty soon. The previous year's schedules have been full of quite innovative stuff, you know, mixed sex events, the sixes, all sorts of different mm-hmm. formats. Do we really want 48, 72 hole stroke play events? I don't think that we do. The PGA Tour's been really, the European Tour's been really good in innovation. Will the PGA Tour's influence kind of dampen down that innovation? Shared broadcasting. I don't know how much of the American coverage of the PGA Tour you see, Ian, but it's essentially cheerleading. The Golf Channel should be renamed the Cheerleading Channel. The other thing was pointed out, do we really, you know, does the European Tour really want a PGA Tour level of refereeing?
Well, I mean, and slow play as well.
Yeah,
I mean, bullseye. Yeah, the European Tour has, and it's very striking when, you know, if you're watching both tours, to see that difference in the pace of play. I think the European Tour is a lot more attractive to watch. You look at what they've done television wise as well. It's got a younger, fresher feel to it through the European Tour productions. But, you know, I don't think you'll struggle to hear a critical voice in the coverage of the European Tour
right.
as well. And you know, that it's an in-house production. So why would there be? You know, that's the whole point of having an in-house production kind of set up. And you've got that in the PGA Tour as well. I think that, you know, the level of amalgamation that we're hinting at there is still a long way off.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's going to be a gradual process. There'll be a kind of sort of creep towards that. And I don't expect it to be a really fast creep either. I think where the most immediate thing that we will see is this element of co-sanctioning and maybe some kind of reworking of the World Golf Championships, because they don't work. I mean, I've been doing this job for nearly 20 years, and I still have to explain to my desks what a WGC is. And I used to be able to get away with going to the tournaments and have people, you know, invest in them, because I say, oh, it's the strata just below the majors, and they say, oh, right, so the winner's the World Golf Champion then. No. You know, it just makes no sense. You know, if you can't get educated or supposedly educated sporting brains to engage in it on a desk of an international sports coverage organization, then what chance have you got of the average golf fan or the average sports fan to sort of buy into it? So I do think anything that kind of simplifies the pecking order in the game has got to be a good thing.
Here, the one last thing, Mark, that this person said on this list was the lack of transparency that the PGA Tour had. You've been dealing with the PGA Tour a long time. I mean, how are they to deal with in terms of, you know, if something happens, remember there was the stuff with DJ and the quote-unquote alleged drugs bans and all that, and the PGA Tour has this policy of never, you know, announcing fines. Actually, Ian, do the European Tour announce fines? I forget.
They do now, yes.
Yeah.
And they do when it suits them. Remember, they announced the fine on Tiger Woods when he spat on the green in Dubai.
But
still a bit dodgy, to be honest. It should be much more transparent than, you know, in the way that it is in other sports.
What's the PGA Tour like, Mark?
Well, I find it very frustrating, Lawrence, because, you know, I cover a lot of other sports as well, where there is accountability. And if somebody does something wrong, you know, it's not swept under a carpet and, oh, we'll take care of this in this little corner over here. I mean, you know, I think there has to be accountability. And if a guy, you know, or a woman or on the women's tour fails a drug test, that should be public knowledge. I'm sorry. That's just the way it should be. I mean, and, you know, it has become a bit comical, as you mentioned, because we've had a couple of scenarios, like you mentioned DJ, who just, you know, all of a sudden has a mysterious wrist injury and is out for 6 months, you know, or whatever it may be, you know, and that's happened to some, you know, lower, you know, lesser name players too on the tour. And you're like, oh, geez, why isn't so? We haven't seen so and so playing in a while. Well, you know, put two and two together.
Yeah, I think it's not fair to the other players, is it, Mark?
Pardon me.
It's not fair to the other players. That's the thing. You know, if a player is off injured, in the current climate, you know, it's perfectly possible for us to for people to start going, oh, that looks a bit dodgy.
No question. And you know, I mean, unless that player has a reputation, you know, as a, you know, whatever, as a drug user or whatever. But I agree with you. It's not. I just think I've never understood why the PGA Tour does it that way. They're punishing the player anyway. Why not make it public? What's the difference whether the public knows or not? I mean, I think it's about accountability, you know. And if anything, maybe it's more of a deterrent for a player who's going to use drugs or some illegal performance enhancing substance not to do so, if you're going to have the embarrassment of everybody knowing that you've been bagged, you know, you've been caught. So yeah, I've never understood that. I've you know, argued with tour officials over it for years, and you know, they just say that's just the way it is. And I'm a little surprised, you know, under the current leadership with Jay Monahan, that maybe that hasn't changed already and might not change. You know, it was that way for all those years under Tim Finchem. I think Jay Monahan's a little bit more of a forward and more progressive thinker. And I'd like to think that maybe that changes under his leadership.
I'd just like to know how much these fines are. I mean, how much would you think? This is a stupid question, but it's a stupid podcast. But yeah, how much do you think Sergio got done for spitting in the cup at Doral? I mean, what's that worth?
Well, the problem too is these guys—they make so much money, and this is just not in this sport. You know, I mean, you know, because in sports where the fines are announced, you think to yourself, you know, like you just mentioned about, you know, loose change in the couch, Lawrence. I mean, so many of these fines are very much so like that. You know, so I mean, if you fine Sergio Garcia $100,000 for spitting in the cup, I mean, that's not really. I mean, it's a slap in the face, and I'm sure he's not happy to have to write that check. But at the end of the day, it's not taking a meal off of Angela's dinner table, I don't think.
Yeah.
They're not going from filet to chuck meat.
Have you any idea? The only insight I ever got on a fine was I quoted an LPGA Tour player in an article, and it was a swear word. And she was mad because she thought I shouldn't have done it. But she got fined $5,000. For usual,
because you wrote that she said that, or
yeah, I quoted her with the F word in the quote, and she got fined $5,000.
How much of that did you pay?
I didn't pay any. That's why she was mad with me. But I just wonder, you know, one fuck, let's say it. Come on, cost her $5,000. I mean, right, Karts. I mean, I know you're a very serious and individual. Sergio Garcia spitting in the cup at Doral. How much? Oh. Come on, I'm going $50,000.
Do you reckon?
Oh, it was no.
I'd say 20. I bet it was 20.
It was, I mean, it was Saturday afternoon golf.
What about when he kicked up the greens in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
I remember once before I covered golf, I covered cricket and a cricket tour in Zimbabwe. And there was a batsman, and I interviewed him after a test match, and he complained vehemently about the level of sledging from the opposition Pakistani team. And as a result of that complaint, he got fined, and he came and sought me out in the press tent after this fine. He said, "You cost me $20,000. It was only Zimbabwe dollars, but and I said, "Oh, well, I'm really sorry, but you said it." He said it, and he said, I know, best, the best $20,000 I've ever spent.
Here, we'll crack up. This is actually, this is much more, the this whole, I'm quite fascinated by all this stuff now, this the politics of this. One final thing, Karts, Ian, sorry, does this cut the PGL off at the knees? Or because I tell you for why I ask, because there's a sort of rumor kicking around that there's a 40-year-olds league in the offing. The names getting kicked around, Adam Scott, Paul Casey, Lee Westwood. I mean, again, it's no doubt just rubbish. The big one would be Tiger Woods. Two things. One, have you heard any of that stuff? And the second question, same to you, Mark, would it work in isolation?
Well, my answer is no, and maybe it would work because we are in that spell where there are a lot of, you know, really good, still playing great golf, 40-somethings who perhaps might not be able to get it done at the biggest events now on the PGA Tour or in the majors, who might be very interested in, you know, having a massive payday there. But I genuinely haven't heard anything, yeah, you know, to that. That's the first time I've heard it.
Social media rumors.
Ian, I mean, what you just mentioned, the two players you just referred to essentially without mentioning their names are Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, yeah, basically, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, this is always what that PGL, that was its biggest attractors, were guys like Phil, you know, who, you know, is not winning, you know, regularly on the tour anymore. Same thing for Tiger, although he did win obviously the Masters in 2019, but, you know, that's the perfect event for those guys because there's still a massive interest to see those guys tee it up regardless of whether they're winning golf tournaments or not. Mm. So to me, that's what that tour is suited perfectly for, but you have to have the Rory McIlroys and the DJs and Brooks Koepkas and, you know, and the top ranked players, the John Rahms of the world, they have to be involved in that for it to work. And I just don't see it happening.
Well,
one thing I would say, Lawrence, is just, you know, how much credence Keith Pelley gave the Rain Group, who are the backers of PGL. I mean, prior to that news conference last week, they were only ever referred to in disparaging terms and like as irrelevances. And what became abundantly clear last week is that they are anything but irrelevant, or have been anything but irrelevant in the last year or so, or however long it's been that they've been sniffing around. And they have deep pockets. They are determined. And there have been several occasions where we thought, well, that's them done. And they've still had an influence, albeit not the one that they've wanted. So I'd be reluctant to say that's them done now. Because, you know, as I say, they are determined and well-resourced.
Well, they've certainly rattled a lot of cages, you know, which obviously precipitated this alliance, quote-unquote alliance, because I think both of the tours are protecting themselves.
The thing about if you get Tiger and Phil, well, whoop-de-doo, but you still have, you've got to find players for them to play against. It's a bit like Celtic and Rangers, isn't it?
Exactly.
They've obviously got deep pockets, Ian, and they're obviously determined, but I'd be a fascinating...
They found Ross County to play Celtic last week.
Right, that's enough. But how do you... It'll be interesting to see... They're in a box, and it'll be interesting to see how they get out of it. That's... I mean, that'll be fascinating. And, of course, my goodness, if Tiger left to go to the PGA. I mean, the PGA Tour couldn't very well say to Tiger, okay, if you go with them, you can't play in our events. I mean, that's not going to happen, is it?
I mean, the dynamics are...
Oh, it's brilliant.
I mean, which PGA Tour sponsor is going to be happy with that scenario?
Yeah, no, it's interesting stuff. This has gone on quite a while. One other thing, Ian, we mentioned, and Mark, actually... Poor Rory, he gets picked on all the time, doesn't he? All these old guys are always picking at him.
And you know what? He gets picked on, and God bless Rory. He does not lash back at these guys. You know, he speaks, you know, in even tones and with great perspective, doesn't he, Ian? I mean, he's just there isn't a person on in the sport that I admire more than him. The way he handles things, and you know, I you know, those Weisskopf comments that we referred to, or the that you just referred to, Lawrence, recently, I guess, when he was saying that essentially he said Rory is not hungry enough and not, you know, doesn't have the fire, you know, to win more majors and whatnot.
Can I just interject just to say, so Tom Weisskopf done a Q&A. Actually, Adam Shukpak, I think the guy's name is, does these really good Q&As. They drop regularly in Golf Week, golfweek.com, if you're anybody's interested. So he's doing this Q&A with Weisskopf. It's a sprawling interview, Q&A, and he's talking about DJ, then out of the blue, Weisskopf just starts talking about Rory. I look at Rory McIlroy and I think his golf is something, it's just something for Rory to do. I said it for a while now that I don't think he'll win much more than the four majors he's got, or maybe five, because I don't see that determination and will to be the best out of the blue. So then Rory is asked later in the week and he says, well, you can read it again, it's a Golf Week. Eamon Lynch spoke to Rory. I've never met Tom Weisskopf in my life. He's never met me. And he goes on, pretty major stuff. Why do people pick on Rory, Mark? Any ideas?
Well, I think because they know he's a pretty nice kid, and he's not a kid anymore. But and maybe they know there's no lashback factor. I don't know. I mean, I the top players in the world are the easiest to pick on, obviously. And you know, people look at Rory and say, "Oh, well, why hasn't he won more?" Okay, whatever. You know, he hasn't won a major since 2014. Et cetera, et cetera. And I just don't see it. You know what? I love the fact that Rory, since before he won anything, was a guy that was very adamant about, you know, leading a full life and an even life and not being obsessed with the game like, say, Tiger was, you know, when he won all those, you know, his first 14 majors anyway, when he was so singularly focused. He had no other life, essentially. And Rory has always been adamant about having a life. And if that's going to be interpreted as somebody who's not hungry enough to win major championships, then I think that's completely false and a very, very poor take.
I've got a theory, Ian. I think it's because we love Rory. Everybody loves Rory, and it's almost like we want him to win every major because he's so exciting, and we're just disappointed with him. And some people can't stop expressing that disappointment in the wrong way, like Tom Weisskopf.
Yeah, I think it's a product of two things. One, the big figure before Rory, and still the big figure, is Tiger, who rewrote the way that the game could be dominated. And then this kid comes along from Northern Ireland who's got such a fantastic instinctive talent, and he wins his first two majors each by 8 shots. And he does it at pretty much the same sort of time frame as Tiger Woods was winning his first majors. And so he's constantly and always been measured in that way. And so, as Mark says, he's not won a major since 2014. So people start asking questions. But one thing I would say, to go back to a football analogy, you know, I support a football team that has never really been in the headlines until the last 5 years, a soccer team. And then all of a sudden they were in the headlines, and suddenly they're being judged by the pundits around the world. And you know, and you love your football team, and you're suddenly reading and listening to pundits and ex-players giving their view on that football team. And you realize that actually they are talking complete and utter rubbish. You know your football team. You know what's going on. You've watched them closely. And I was just reminded of that when I read what Tom Weisskopf had said there. Because you can level an awful lot of things at Rory, you know, for not adding to his major tally, for constantly in recent times struggling to find good golf when he's needed it at majors. But the one thing you can't question is his passion and his love for the game and his work ethic and the way that he has applied himself to it. And he's done it in a balanced way, as Mark was referencing as well. To me, if you were saying to a young kid, who should you emulate as a figure at the very top of sport, I can't think of a better example than Rory McIlroy. The way that he conducts himself, the way that he applies himself to his sport, and the way that he plays it. And yes, he's not winning as much as a lot of people would have wanted him to, but you know, the guy's not missed a cut for over a year.
Yeah.
You know, Ian, let's not forget here that you know, we're referencing 2014, for example, as that kind of that cutoff point for Rory in terms of the majors. You know, the game since Rory has arrived to it in his prime is so much deeper and more difficult to win. There's so many better players out there, and which I think makes it more difficult to win majors than it was. Taking zero away from Tiger, by the way, but Tiger kind of came out and he was so incredibly talented, and he had a different work ethic in terms of his drive physically to be better than everybody else, that it took a long time for the rest of the game to catch up to him. And now people have caught up to Tiger, you know, and during that period, that's when Rory's come around. And you can't argue in the last 6 or 7 years, you know, say 6 years since Rory won his last major, the game is deeper and better than it's ever been, and that makes it more difficult to win majors. So, you know, I know that probably sounds like an excuse, but it's just reality.
Yeah, but the other reality, is that when Rory has had a chance, he's generally gone backwards. The 2018 Open at Carnoustie being the exception to that, where, you know, he was in the mix and someone better beat him. But, you know, you think of the times that he's either played himself out of majors with poor first rounds, or when he's got himself into position, then thrown in a bad one, whether it be in second, third or fourth round. And that has just been a recurring theme. I think there is an issue there, but the issue is not his commitment or his desire or any of the kind of things that Tom Weisskopf went after him on.
Actually, Mark, you were on the premises at Augusta. What was he like? Did you get much interaction with him at Augusta? How was he? He must have been gutted, I don't know.
Well, he was gutted early. I did speak to him a couple of times, Lawrence, and I know, you know, he came out of that kind of admitting, you know, I talked to him specifically after his round on Saturday when he had played with Bernard Langer, which was fascinating to watch. And, you know, he was very, very bummed out about and very, very transparent about the fact that he was kind of playing not to lose on Thursday. He was not going after the golf course as aggressively as he felt like he should have. And he kind of, in a way, he was admitting that Augusta was in his head a little bit and he played a little too tentatively. It'll be fascinating to see in April if he comes out, you know, kind of swinging for the fences, for lack of a better, you know, to use a baseball jargon. On the Thursday first round, because he played really brilliantly in the last three rounds. He opposite to what his path has been, as Ian referenced, and he has had a final round issue that's been going on for a while. His scoring average is markedly worse on Sundays than it has been in the first three rounds. Oddly enough, the Masters was the opposite. And that's the one thing I do like about Rory. One of the many things is he was very honest and said, you know what, I feel like I played a little bit too tentatively the first round. And, you know, they always say, the saying is obviously you can lose a major championship on Thursday, but you can't win it. At the end of the day, I think in trying to do that, Rory actually ended up kind of losing his chance at winning the Masters on Thursday because he was too tentative.
Here, I've got one interesting stat from the Masters, and then we'll finish with a question to you, Ian. And Rory pointed this out. Of all the players who made the cut at Augusta this year, he finished last in strokes gained approach. So his wedge play is garbage. I think he's identified that. So
yeah, he just said that he couldn't find a way to get to those back pin positions. Yeah. And playing the first two rounds with Dustin Johnson, he saw how it should be done, and he'll go away and he'll work on it. Yeah. That is the issue for him. And, you know,
can I just say, maybe the issue is physical and not psychological.
Once he couldn't win the Masters, once that was in his head, then he played with freedom. Mm. And look at the scores that he had. You know, Portrush, the Open Championship, that was the biggest major he could ever play. And suddenly, you know, when that pressure is on, something gets in the way, and suddenly he hits an opening tee shot with an iron 50 yards left of where he needs to hit it, and it goes out of bounds. Yeah, and so he shoots, what was it, 79 in the first round there. He's out of the championship
What does he do the next day? Shoots 65, almost makes the cut. And he shot 67 in the first round at the US Open. So the first round problems have gone. So what does he do? Throws in a bad second round. So, and then once he's out of contention, he can play again. Those are the recurring issues that are there for Rory. And I'm not saying that, you know, in a critical way. He's saying it himself. He talked about the fact that he couldn't find any freedom in that first round at Augusta. And it's something that he has to address. He has to find a way. But I know for a fact, and I know him well enough, that when he plays poorly, it really pisses him off. And he cares. And he wants to play well. And he knows how talented he is. And
take
he knows
that Tom Weisskopf.
But he makes it.
I see. Weisskopf, right? There we go.
Weisskopf was a great player. Winner of the 73 Open. Brilliant swing. They thought he was from Ohio. They thought he was going to kick Nicholas out of the way. That didn't happen. Anyway, good player. Good golf course
designer
as well. Yeah, Loch Lomond.
How good is Loch Lomond?
Yeah. Although there is a theory that Jay Morris was his partner there. I think they've since fallen out. But I think there's a theory that Jay Morris did all the good stuff. But anyway, who knows? One other thing on Rory, Ian. Does he transcend golf? You know, so remember when you would call the news desk and it'd be a Tiger story. And yes, absolutely. Same with you, Mark. Does Rory sort of jump across into the mainstream still with you, Ian, when you call the news desk or whatever?
He does more than any other European golfer, but I don't think he does as much as he did. You know, not in the same way as was, you know, and you look at his. Yeah, his old sponsorship deals kind of did that, didn't they? You know, he had deals with a bank and then with the headphones people and all of that. And that seems to have kind of gone away a little bit. And I think also in the UK, I think the fact that he's opted to represent Ireland in the Olympics has just kind of diminished his transcendency or however you want to say it, how much he transcends. But he's still a massive figure. There's no doubt about that. But you know, he's based in America. I would think he is a bigger figure in America than he is in the UK. And he obviously is a massive figure in Ireland.
I don't know that I agree with that, Ian. I mean, I mean, Pete. Listen, he's revered here. There's no question about it. But in answer to Lawrence's question, I don't really see him as a guy that. I'm in the newspaper business at a newspaper that is more national than parochial, so to speak, and you know, New York, where we kind of, you know, write not just New Yorkers, but certainly in golf it's nationally. And I don't, you know, Tiger is the only player that transcends, you know, the, in my opinion, and still to this case now, when he's still not, you know, he's getting on in age and not winning. Rory is just a very much a revered figure that people love. And as Lawrence said before, root for, because he is a nice guy and is very honest and transparent, wears it on his sleeve. So I don't consider him. I still feel, even though he's based in the States, I still believe he's more revered in Europe. That's my feeling from this side of the pond, so to speak.
He got some tracks from you with that Trump stuff, though, Mark, didn't he? Oof, that took off.
That was pretty good, yes. It was good for McKellar and the podcast too,
yeah,
wasn't
it? Was.
It?
I see. There's some the post publication stuff. I probably can't see on the podcast, but there was some stuff went on. Anyway, he said, "What a dick I for saying that." But anyway, whatever. Here, we love Rory, part 75. Ian Carter, thanks for coming on. It was brilliant having you, pal. Come on.
No,
again.
It's great. Great to catch up again, Lawrence. Thank you. I'm a huge fan of the pod. So it's a great honour to be on it. Thank
oh, there you.
You
go. Well, and we're going to have you. We were discussing Mark before we came on air, Ian and I. We've got to get Ian in the magazine. We've got to get Ian in issue 5 of McKellis. We've got to come up with some story ideas. Anyway, for another day. Mark, good to talk to you, pal.
Good talking to you. And Ian, always good talking to you. I'm looking forward to the day when we can actually be at the same event together.
Likewise, my friend. Likewise. Very much so.
reach out just to touch you. Then I realize it's a wide open.